It is Saturday, July 11th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and a discussion about particle physics, specifically Higgs field and dark matter. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're starting with geek news in the first half, and in the second half, a particle physicist, Linda Carpenter, to chat about the LHC, the Higgs particle, and dark matter. It should be a fun discussion about particle physics today on the show. During the second half, I'll also welcome you to join our conversation if you'd like to ask us questions about particle physics, specifically and only about particle physics today. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can ask us anything you'd like at geekspeak.org through our forums or sending us email directly. And I'll give it that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, our geeks. Al Luckow, he's a new media architect. Good morning.
Good morning.
We tested that and everything.
Hello. Is it working?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Al Luckow. We also have Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe's a freelance media guy and a Stanford instructor.
Morning. Good morning.
We have our guest, Linda Carpenter. Linda Carpenter is a particle physicist, and we'll be introducing her in the second half when we start talking about particle theory. You're welcome to participate in the news if you'd like, Linda.
Thanks, and good morning.
And we also have one of the founding Geek Speak members, John Tracy. Welcome, John Tracy.
Am I a founding member?
Sure. Yeah. You've been doing it for 9 years, so yeah, I'd say so. Hey, John, you work at Acelion. Your current title is?
I'm a technical writer, tech support.
Okay. Right. And you're also kind of our space geek, if you will. Yeah. So you got a space news story for us today?
Sure.
All right.
Actually, it's an update more than a news story.
That works.
I don't know if you folks have been following our two rovers on Mars. They landed there almost 5.25 years ago. They had a 90-day warranty when they landed, meaning they were supposed to do science for 3 months. They have far exceeded anyone's expectations. Currently, there's a Free Spirit campaign. Spirit is one of the rovers. It's been stuck since May. It's on a sloped... it's on an incline of loose sand. It's got a rock under its oil pan. Okay, it's not really an oil pan, but under the belly. That's keeping it from moving. So if you go up to NASA.gov and look around for the Mars stuff, you can see some interesting stuff that JPL has been doing. They've got a rover at JPL that they use to test different things. They've got a sandbox they've made. They've approximated using clay and other soil composites. Mm-hmm. They've approximated the Martian soil. And they've got this giant sandbox at an incline with a rock under it, and they put the rover in it, and they're trying all these different things to get it unstuck.
Science.
They've got some videos up there, and it's I don't know, maybe I'm just a space geek, but it's interesting to watch them use this to develop the program that they'll need to run on this other one to get it free.
Right. I mean, let me ask you this. Have they attempted any moves already?
On the one that's stuck?
On the actual?
They did a few. Just to like, wow, where are we? What are we in?
Yeah.
They did a few to try to reposition it to get some better images of what was going on. They ended up using, it's got an arm on the end of the rover.
Yeah.
There's an arm on the rover, and on the end are a few tools. One of those tools is an imager that's made to take pictures of stuff like, 10 centimeters away or less. They pointed it underneath the rover and took a whole panorama of pictures, really fuzzy because that's not what the tool is made for. But, that's where they found out, it's on a rock, the tires are doing this, and they spun the wheels to see what would happen. And they have tried a little bit to move it, but they realized, okay, we don't want to get it more stuck. We want to do some tests here on Earth where we can control everything.
Right. Yeah. Cool. I mean, it's interesting, because even with photographs and stuff, you can't emulate perfectly what you're on and how the work, is the rock really sharp at the point or is it kind of a rounded rock right at the top?
They can tell it's sharp because the backlighting showed very sharp focus of what the rock was like.
Oh, cool. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the update on our pals on Mars. I think we'll jump over to other robots. One's more local, probably. Al, hi.
Oh, hi. How's it going?
Good.
You know, I was thinking about that Mars sandbox thing. You know, one thing that really works good in a sandbox is one of those little red plastic shovels.
That's true. Why don't they have one of those?
Why didn't they bring one of those when they went?
We should send one.
Yeah. Yeah, how much could they weigh, really?
FedEx isn't going to charge that much, right?
You know, there's some sandbox in my house, all sorts of little things
in
there.
Send kids up, too.
Yeah.
Kids
that would,
can definitely
that would really be a good thing. There's a lot of things happening with robots, but I ran across something that is truly, truly terrifying. Now, I don't really, you know, we say, oh, we put these links up on GeekSpeak and you should go check them out. I'm telling you, you got to watch this link about this one robot, okay? It's called Big Dog. It's by Boston Dynamics, okay? And this thing is 240 pounds and it looks like a dog. Imagine a gigantic Rottweiler, a 240-pound Rottweiler with no head. Okay, and that's what this thing is, and they show this thing walks like a dog. They show it climbing up the hills and jumping around, going between trees and stuff. Then they show it like, oh, it comes across ice and it starts to fall down, and then it like gets its balance. And they show a guy walk up to it and push it, and the thing like staggers and like compensates. And this is a 240-pound gigantic.
Robotish dog.
Robot dog.
And it wasn't a gentle push either. He was trying to push it down.
Pushes that thing. And it's just like, and it makes this growl the whole time.
Growls.
And so you got to watch this on YouTube.
All right,
you'll look at it and you'll go, man, now I'm scared. And you know, I said last week that if you're worried about somebody being a robot, just ask them to walk up some stairs. I'm not so sure that would work in this case.
Or give them a really a hard push.
Oh, that thing's horrific.
Yeah. If you really suspect somebody being a robot, oh, that's the noise it makes. It makes this noise. It's like a thousand killer bees. If you really suspect somebody being a robot, just
listen to that sound.
If they smell like a brand new plastic soccer ball, that right there.
That's the proof of
that's robotness. All we've got right now.
All right. Any other robot stories that
I've got,
I know.
Lots of robot stories. You can, but it's up to
you're
you.
Like the repository
there's one,
of robots.
There's one. I'll bring up one.
Yeah.
It's a self-portrait machine. All right. Somebody came up with this idea that wouldn't it be great if you could strap yourself into a machine so your arms were bound to this machine, and then the machine would look at you and make you draw a self-portrait of yourself.
Oh, I'm not liking this so far.
This was at the Royal College of Art where they did this. And they have – that's also a link. And they show the thing. And the guy – I mean, I don't know. There's no – I don't know if there's a –
How well do the portraits come out?
Well, they don't look that great.
Yeah, are they like cartoons?
They're like cartoons.
Some form of medieval torture to have to look at.
But, the thing is –
a very bad reproduction of yourself that you yourself made.
The reproductions are – as an artist, I can say they're adequate. But, sometimes some people take a long time to draw. John's got a beard now. So that's a lot of hairs in there. What if the computer decides I'm going to draw every single hair? And you're strapped into this thing. You got to go to the bathroom.
Well, can you turn it up to 11? Can you make it do it really fast so then you're forced to draw?
I don't think once you're in it.
High speed.
There's potential injury.
Do you
there.
Know?
It does what it wants.
What's it called?
It's called a self-portrait machine. They don't have a name for it. They show
it's
it.
Really working. How do you turn this thing off? That's the question. You're drawing, and you're like, okay, I have to go to the bathroom. How do you turn this thing off? Your arms are bound.
That's what I'm saying.
Do they have like a kill switch by your foot or something?
To be clear, safe word. This is a safe word.
You have to draw a certain image.
Stop. So the site is We Make Money, Not Art. So it's clearly an art project, but fantastic.
Things start out as art, and then
they take over the world.
That's
true.
So anyway, there's lots more, but that's enough terrifying robot news stories for you today.
Thank you.
I'm Ben. Scared.
Ben, SoundSense?
Yes, SoundSense is this piece of software that researchers at Dartmouth College have created, and it runs on the iPhone. It's like an iPhone application, and it takes all of the audio input from the microphone, and it uses that to try to track and interpret activities that users go through during their day. Like, it listens to what your cell phone hears and tries to figure out where you are and what you're doing. Like, it can...
Isn't this part of a Batman movie?
Yes, this is...
So you leave the app has to be running, though, right?
So yeah. You have to be running the. That would be amazing if you had an application which could do things when it wasn't running. Mm-hmm. But but no.
Well,
but
actually, there is background processes now in Apple and the iPhone, I believe.
Is it in 3.0?
Maybe it's just for triggering. But anyway, let's go on.
But anyway, this application can classify sounds as voice or music or ambient noise. There's kind of a training
or crazy Boston Dynamics big dog robots.
What would it do if it heard that sound?
I don't know.
Run now.
Run. Yeah, exactly. Run
so
now.
So it keeps a log of what you're doing during the day.
Yeah, and it also allows you to calibrate it. So you can label something as a significant sound or an insignificant sound or a sound that you don't want it to remember. And when they were testing this software, it was able to identify where they were, if they were in a particular coffee shop or walking outside or brushing their teeth or cycling or driving in a car. Those were some of the examples they gave. And it's just picking out these noises, and it's really interesting. But my question is, doesn't the iPhone have a GPS device already? So,
yes.
Does it really need to know? Maybe I guess for when you're
it kind of tells you
in a coffee shop versus the barbershop next door, you know where you are. I don't know. I'm sure there's some interesting applications of this.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
If it develops, yeah.
So, John, thank you, Ben. So, John, how good are Americans at science?
Well, there's a little disparity between what the scientists believe and the American public believes. Actually, we were watching the Colbert Report, and Neil deGrasse Tyson, the physicist, was on.
Love him.
He was saying 50% of Americans do not know that the Earth goes around the sun in 1 year.
Right.
It takes 1 year for that to happen.
Really? That's how long it takes.
On average. They also found that out of 9 out of 10 scientists have accepted the idea of evolution as a method of natural selection. I'm sorry, evolution by natural selection is real.
9 out of 10, that's pretty good.
Yeah, there's a third of the American public believes that.
Only a third believes?
One third.
Wow.
84% of scientists say Earth is getting warmer because of human activity. Less than half the public agrees with that. There's a bunch of numbers here. I have a feeling we're not spending enough on science in school.
Still
not money, but time and energy.
Especially on salaries.
Can you get your mic a little closer, Linda? Thank you.
Yep.
Especially on salaries?
Yeah.
Especially mine. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, so is this depressing to you like it is to me?
Yeah, it is. And it goes with a whole slew of Americans sucking at different things educationally. Why did I even bring this up? Now I'm all depressed.
I know. Let's see if we can get some.
Go on to the next thing.
Last night we were chatting about this, Linda.
Yep.
We were chatting about, Ben and I are really upset that people believe that homeopathy is totally, a functioning, useful thing. And there's a big argument about it. But your perspective was pretty optimistic, and I have to say that I appreciate it. So can you share that with me?
Yeah, I think that, before the 19th century, there was no such thing as science at all, and it was only codified as a method and a method of thought, 150 years ago. And now people know what a scientific method is. I mean, they might not know what a control group is in an experiment and that kind of thing, and they might not know about, logical fallacies like post hoc, ergo propter hoc, and these kind of things. But they know, they know that mice aren't spontaneously generated from straw. Right? They know that witchcraft isn't responsible for cattle getting sick, whereas in 1706 there were still witch trials. And I think that people do now, they want to know what medical studies say. Now, the studies might be completely absurd, and people have no criterion for evaluating them. But I think that definitely more people know more science than they ever did before.
So in the long term sense, like 150 years, we're doing pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, we could always be doing better, and we should always strive to do better.
Well,
but
most of the witches are gone now. I mean, they took care of all that in the Salem and all that.
So, John, does that make you not as depressed? It's true, right?
Okay, if you take the long view term, but if you compare us globally to other first world nations, how are we comparing scientifically?
Mm. Yeah, right. we're not doing so hot. But
especially considering that we were the first, so far the only country to put people on another planet. I mean, we come from
planet.
A nation.
No.
Okay, moon. Pluto. Sorry,
yeah, yeah.
I consider Pluto
a
planet.
It depends on how you define planet, right?
Yeah.
Moving on. Thank you, John, very much for that. See, even we suck in science.
We don't suck. I have to say, I've taught for many years. People are interested in science. If you tell someone you're a physicist, for example, they'll ask you all kinds of questions.
You're a physicist? What's the Higgs particle? Okay, wait, no, 10 more minutes. Al.
Yes.
Mobile phone charger?
Oh, well, you know, you'd think there's no hope for the human race after all this. We don't know anything about science. Mm-hmm. But the European Union has come up with an idea. Why don't we standardize the mobile phone chargers that we're using? That way, every time we buy a new mobile phone, we won't have to throw away this one-pound brick that comes with it every
Progress.
Time.
Progress.
That is awesome.
Think of the genius. I mean, of course, you know, it's sort of happening. You know, Apple, whenever you buy something from Apple, it's a USB. You plug it into a little thing.
Yeah, Apple's kind of
doing
that.
And so you can kind of reuse those things. But, I mean, you got Nokia and you got all these companies, and they want to standardize this plug.
Why not use
USB? Wait, the companies are cool with this?
Yeah, it's Apple, Nokia, Samsung, and others have agreed to adopt a charging standard for data-enabled mobile devices based on USB. So, essentially, they're doing
I didn't hear Motorola in there, did I?
They didn't say Motorola in there, but
that's a problem because Motorola is like 90% of their own market.
it's hope that the standard will be adopted worldwide.
Yeah,
but I mean,
well, the EU that makes
sense. A no brainer. What I mean,
absolutely. Last night, Linda didn't have her cell phone charger for Motorola, and I went through my box of stuff and couldn't find it.
I've got a box just full of, you know, adapters.
Oh yeah,
that I keep collecting these things. Every time you get a new thing.
So the thing is, do you know how to read them and actually reuse them? Because I reuse them all the time.
You know what? I just have my wife look at them.
Yeah, that's what
she's got a degree in engineering, and she can look at it and tell me whether I'm going to blow it up or not.
Yeah.
So generally, that's what I do. But
if the device fits, that doesn't mean that it's a good thing to plug in.
What's the key thing to look at, Lyle?
The key thing to look at is the polarity and the voltage. The amperage really has to do with how much power is available. But you want to look at the voltage. And you want to get the polarity correct.
The voltage is it which will burn it out?
If the voltage is high or the polarity is reversed, you'll fry your device. So if you look at the actual little, what I call a wall wart, those things that you plug into the wall that look like a wart with a cord on it, that's a wall wart.
A square wart.
Yeah. You'll normally notice on the back of it, there'll be a little symbol that has like a circle with a plus in it or a minus in it.
Right, right. I've
like
seen
a circle, a C with a circle in it and two lines coming off it. One says minus and plus. And the inside one is the tip and the outside is the ring. Mm-hmm. So if you see that symbol and it says inside, you know, plus, that means the tip is plus. If you look at the device you're trying to charge, it's going to have something similar to that too. And you just want to make sure that those match.
So you got
to
match all that and also the voltage.
And also the voltage.
Like three
that's not
numbers.
Standard? That's not standard? Oh, just even whether the inside or outside is
positive. No, it's not. That's the thing that's so frustrating.
Really?
And think then how many resources we'd save just by doing this one little thing. I mean, you could take all the fluorescent light bulbs in the world.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
no,
I mean, it's true.
It's just like, duh, you know? So
the other thing that's not
know.
Standard is that sometimes they're AC and DC. That's another thing. Don't do that. Anyway, be careful with charging up devices.
That's coming, so this and it's could a really positive thing. This is something good and probably will happen. And
okay, and just to support what John was saying earlier, that's the EU, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, it's not the U.S.
Right, but it's two letters, and U.S. is two letters.
That's true.
And so then really there's one vowel, two vowels.
There.
Never mind.
We're getting there.
They both have a U.
Yes.
John, we did both your stories.
I can make things up.
No, don't make things up. We'll go to... Ben, about Pandora?
Yeah, so everyone's been kind of worried that Pandora's been has been about to go away because of pricing and, you know, they're providing the streaming service, which is free.
Pandora is a internet streaming service. You go to a web browser, you put in like a name of a song that you like, and it will play music like that.
Yes, and it's very, very cool, and I've used it for...
Too much.
8 months, 10 months, I don't know. I don't want to see it go away either. And so everyone's kind of worried about that because they have to pay royalties for all of the songs that they play. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they've worked out a deal and everything, but it's still expensive and they're providing the service for free. So recently they've decided that they're going to make it a pay service, but not a normal pay service where you have to pay to use the service to begin with. You can play for 40 hours for free.
A week?
40 hours per month.
Okay.
And then after 40 hours, you have to pay... 99 cents
for the rest of the month.
For the rest of the month, 99 cents $1.
That's not too bad.
So that's I hopefully that will be sufficient.
If you're listening to Pandora that much too.
Yeah, hopefully that'll be sufficient to cover the royalties they have to pay and everything and licensing fees because that's not very much. And I think I would do that.
It may be $12 a year.
Yeah.
At max.
Yeah.
That sounds fine.
Totally reasonable.
Yeah, for as much music as you can listen to. Yeah. You know, I mean. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's that. So that's good news for those of us who use Pandora.
We'll keep going.
Exactly, because it's cheap for us, and Pandora will stay going, and that's good for them.
Speaking of Pandora, we got a great email request about using an HDMI port on a Windows machine to play audio through it and actually be able to play Pandora audio through it. Because the thing is, I don't have an answer to that. And if one of our listeners, who's kind of a more of a Windows expert, especially with high-definition television, if you know how to get the rest of your sound source to go through the HDMI out port, it would be great for us to know, and you could just send us a note.
They were saying that the DVD player would play the audio through the HDMI port, but nothing else would.
And that does make sense because, well, we won't get into that.
Yeah.
Because I want to keep going. Yeah. And I just got an updated question from Miles, who's on the road right now going to a wedding. Miles asks, who are the 10% of scientists, John, who don't believe evolution is a reality?
The Pew Report doesn't name names.
Why not? Because it'd be hatred.
Well, why don't you
Joe Smith from blah, blah university.
Just get 100 scientists in a room. Uh-huh. 10 of them don't believe in it, right?
That's wrong. That's horrible.
I don't know.
That's which 10? That's the question.
Yeah.
No, I get that.
The same ones, like, that don't use dentine. Think that
they can't be biologists, right?
Who counts? Are they, like, scientists? I mean, are they counting like?
Right, are they counting everybody that's a scientist?
Are these people with PhDs, are they counting, like, doctors?
I wonder if the model's different if you count just biologists.
Yeah, it doesn't specify. It was 2,000 scientists, 2,000 Americans.
All right. Well, I think we've got time for one more story. Go for it, Al.
Google came out with a new OS, or they're going to come out with an OS that's going to supposedly challenge Microsoft and Mac and all that kind of stuff. There isn't a whole lot known about it, but except that it'll be free, just like everything they give away. Let's just all think that, nothing is really free, and Google is becoming a gigantic company. If you see the logo even for the logo for Google Chrome, it looks just like a Simon.
Simon Says.
It's that toy that, it would play the tune, and then you could play it back.
It's just missing one color.
Yep. That's curious to me. But, they're coming out with this OS, and it's going to be free, just like everything, and... I don't have a problem with them giving anything away free, and I think that it's great that somebody's challenging Microsoft and all these kinds of things. And I'm happy about all this. It just worries me that one company seems to be giving in so much to one company. That's what bugs me a little bit.
Do you feel that's the hidden cost?
I think the hidden cost is that they were going to control every aspect of our lives.
I, for one, welcome the Google overlord.
Yeah. It is kind of nice, though, being able to find stuff for the search engine.
So... What they're doing is they're taking a Linux-based kernel, they're making their own distribution, and they're going to focus on making a very good internet OS, meaning that right now, when you deal with internet applications, and Google has a lot of them. Google has a word processing document thing that's online and a spreadsheet document online.
So it's all based on the internet. It's not really like your traditional one where it's on your computer.
In as much as they're going to make a really dumbed-down OS that runs their browser really well.
Right.
And from some perspective, it makes a lot of sense. We recommend for like netbooks and such, these really small-end books, if you're not going to be editing video, if you're not going to be needing Photoshop, you can go ahead and run Linux. But of course, if you start doing that, you come down to the whole space of having to understand your distribution, understand getting a live CD, and there's not a big name behind it. But if there's a Google name, a trusted name like that, then consumers, I'm assuming, Granny might run it.
It is a good idea. It's a great idea, actually.
You won't be able to game on it, and you probably won't be able to use that old scanner.
Well, they're saying you can make apps to run in it. They've got all these different things. It's better speed. It's always there.
No, that's great. That's been true about Linux for a long time, but that doesn't mean that the game developer are doing that.
Yeah.
In any case, I think we should... mention that you're listening to Geek Speak right now, and my name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Al Luckow, he was just speaking, Ben Jaffe, John Tracy, and our guest today is Linda Carpenter, and in a moment we'll be chatting with her. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Okay, so today on Geek Speak we have Linda Carpenter. She has a BS in physics from the University of USC.
That's the one.
I made it. And you also have a PhD in physics from Johns Hopkins. Your dissertation is on supersymmetry.
Yep.
So you're definitely a particle physicist.
Yep. I'm a postdoc at UC Santa Cruz.
Currently. Yeah. And what are you doing after your postdoc at UC Santa Cruz?
No, I'm a postdoc at UC Irvine.
Oh, Irvine,
so
sorry.
I'm staying in this wonderful and bankrupt state.
Okay, good. I'm glad you're going to stay around. All right. So let me ask you about field theory and how it relates to how gravity exists with the Higgs particle.
Okay, well, that was a lot of...
I know, it's a lot. So first off, also get your mic. That's great. Just stay right like that. Go for it.
Right. First time on the radio. Right. So I assume that people sort of mix up talking about the Higgs and talking about gravity, because particle physicists are always saying that the Higgs particle is responsible for giving other particles their mass.
Yeah.
And this is a particle that we're going to be looking for at the LHC, which is the Large Hadron Collider, which is a giant experiment turning on in the fall.
The biggest machine made by man,
yeah.
I think.
27
kilometers in circumference, goes under two towns, spans two countries. It's in Switzerland and France. Yeah. And
is it noisy?
Good question.
I know a lot about this.
Of course. Oh, okay.
Asking very good questions.
Yeah. Those,
they actually can't turn it on
it goes
in the
like
winter.
This. Oh. Whatever that dog
really?
Noise is, it's worse than that. Yeah. they can't turn it on in the winter. They deflect, you know, all that energy to heat up Europe, basically. So I mean, the LHC, yeah, draws a lot of power. So it sort of broke a little bit last fall, but that's okay because it wouldn't have run in the winter anyway, and it's going to run all through next winter. So we're going to get a little bit of time back,
right? Because they're going to go ahead
and I can explain to you exactly.
A lot of the Europeans won't have heat during that time.
I don't want to know how it broke right now, but I am interested. So how does a particle
get a mass?
A particle produce mass? Okay. Like why is that happening?
So I'm going to make an analogy here because I don't want to get into higher mathematics.
Speak.
So let's imagine that there is a field which is absolutely full of swarming bees. Just completely full of bees. Okay. Now, this is like a field which, you know, permeates all space. It's a field of bees. Now imagine that you're a person and you walk through such a field, you know. So you walk through the field bees collect around you and they start stinging you. Now, like, this is you're trying to, like, move through this field of bees, but you've become
attached.
A giant ball of millions of bees stinging you, right? So as your motion through this field will be impeded. So it's sort of like you've gained a lot of mass by walking through the cloud of bees, because the bees are strongly interacting with you by stinging you.
Right? Be moving
fast. And they're also flying in the same direction you're flying.
Well, let's think about it. Let's assume that you've fallen down and the bees start stinging you. Now it's really hard for you to get up and get going, right? Bees are stinging you. So it's very hard for you to, like, start moving. And once you do move, you're flailing around and running like crazy. It's going to be really hard to stop you.
Does this have a good ending? Because I'm a little nervous.
No.
So once you have all these bees around you, though, you're not going to – the other bees aren't going to affect you, the ones that are just kind of flying around, because they'll just see bees.
All I'm saying is that you've gained an effective mass. Like, instead of being just a person, now you're like a person in a huge cloud of bees. Hmm. You're a person in a huge cloud of bees. It's hard to stop you once you're moving, and it's hard to get you going once you've stopped. And that's what we call an inertial mass. So, like, mass is resistance to change in motion. So once something has an ocean liner is a lot harder to get going than a sports car because it's more massive. It's harder to change direction, and it's harder to stop it once it is going.
If I can switch your metaphor a little bit to talk about people in a crowd, if I'm like a celebrity and there's a whole bunch of people around me, a bunch of fans, I can travel through the field if I can get all those people that are surrounding me to keep going. I don't get impeded by the people in the area as much, and therefore I can continue to go. But as soon as I try to change that direction, I have to stop all those people.
Well, imagine that you're a famous person in a crowd, right? So now the crowd is going to be like the field of Higgs bosons,
right?
And you're moving through this background field of Higgs particles, right? And people come to talk to you, and as they come to talk to you, you become effectively just a big blob of people, a giant blob of people, much more massive than you are just by yourself, you know. So now what's moving through the crowd is this giant wave of people in a big cluster. And that thing is massive. It's hard to stop once it's moving, and it's hard to get going once it stops.
Okay.
And this is what we call an inertial mass. So
right. That's great. And let me just ask a little more detail about that.
Yep.
When you've got that giant crowd of people, why is it, or in the particle world translation of this, why is it that that larger group can travel through the field without without friction, if you will? Why is it that when it starts moving, it doesn't...
Without friction.
Meaning inertia doesn't restrict. There's not like some static space. Like, I think of a crowd of people as basically standing still, but of course we're not talking about things standing still. Does the metaphor keep going, or does it kind of break? Meaning that if you actually did this and you had a whole bunch of people around you and tried to move through a group of people, you would actually slow down.
You would actually slow down. So if you're trying to move through a group of people, you would actually slow down. I mean, this is sort of the point.
This
of the
is
Higgs
where
you slow down, you gain a mass. It's harder to move.
So which one is the Higgs particle? Is it the people coming to you, or do you?
The Higgs particle, like, okay, no. The Higgs as its own particle is something slightly different. How the Higgs gives you mass is sort of this way that the field clusters around you and makes you hard to move. the particle itself are only oscillations of the field of people without an extra particle in it. So let's imagine that now a room full of people, somebody starts a vicious rumor in a room full of people. Then now the rumor makes people sort of cluster together in a lump, and then they lean over and talk to other people next to them and pass the rumor. So it makes like a little traveling ball of people. That's like a Higgs particle.
So it's like
it's not the people moving, it's the interactions of the people.
Yeah, it's like a clump. It's like a wave of water. You can say that the wave moves, but really it's just, you know, a little water displacing itself a little bit.
So the particle would actually be the transferring of the rumor.
The particle is sort of like a traveling wave. Like if you take a string and make it really taut and make a pulse on it, the pulse travels. So the particle is like the traveling pulse on a string. Or it's the traveling cluster of people in a room full of people.
I think I actually saw that at the Clapton concert a couple weeks ago in the crowd.
You found the Higgs?
Yeah, I think I found the Higgs. I didn't know it was the Higgs at the time.
Great. That's great.
What was the rumor?
I just saw the whole crowd moving.
Someone said, this is heavy, man.
I thought, this must be, wonder what that's called.
All right. How do you actually detect, why is it that the LHC will give us, and I know the LHC is going to give a lot more energy. That's the big thing. It's going to be a lot more energy, really close to the Big Bang point. Why is it that with a lot more energy, somehow you'll be able to see the Higgs? Why is it that we get it to detect it when it has more energy?
Well, so the Higgs is pretty massive. We know that, for example, it has to be more than 114 giga electron volts. So right now I'm speaking of masses in terms of energy, because that's what we do as particle physics.
Sure.
And if this seems weird to you, by the way, this shouldn't seem so weird, because we often use ridiculous units for things. For example, if I ask you how far away is San Francisco, you'll tell me an hour. You tell me not an hour and...
An hour and a half,
right? Yeah. That's not a distance, is it? No, it's a time, right? So you multiply that by a velocity, and I go, okay, so then it must be like, what, 80 miles, something like that. So often we speak of things in screw units. So when I talk about mass in terms of energy, it shouldn't...
That's fine. Can you...
But yeah, the Higgs boson is heavy. It's heavy, so we have to be able to produce it. So when you do,
can you compare it to another particle that I'm aware of, like a proton, neutron, well, same, electron? What range of mass are we talking about?
It's so a proton is what we call 1 giga electron volt.
And this thing's how big?
It's bigger than 114 giga electron volts. So.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a lot of mass.
That's a lot, yeah.
But we don't, it doesn't, okay, so it's got a lot of mass. Of course, it doesn't have any charge.
That's right. No charge.
Okay, so how do we detect it?
So we hope to produce it and then look at its decay product. So it's going to decay heavily into things which have a large coupling to it. So the heavier quarks, basically. So we're looking for Higgs to two bottom quarks. That's the main signal. So then we look for the decay products of the bottom quark. So the bottom so a quark is some sort of bizarre fermion that has an extra force that isn't electromagnetism or the weak force. It couples to things through its own thing called the strong force, which is strong and messy. And there are six kinds of quarks, and the bottom is one.
So once you've detected it, though, and you know everybody like, hey, we found this waste matter and all this kind of stuff, and we've got, you know, does everybody just have a big party, drink some champagne, and go home and just like, yeah, wasn't that great when we discovered
that?
Is there a purpose for finding this thing? And
so we'll be very happy if we find it. In fact, so we think it exists because we think that this is the mechanism through which particles get their mass. But another reason we want it is because you can do experiments scattering known particles off of each other. And so you basically calculate the probability that a particle will bounce off another particle, okay? Without the Higgs, if we do this calculation, we get a probability. As you go up in energy, that probability starts to diverge. It gets greater than one. That doesn't make any sense. So we actually need some new particle in the theory to make it make sense. So that's another reason why we
expect... So it's predictable, right.
...to find the Higgs.
So it's useful for testing lots of things.
It's useful for making our... theories make sense.
Wow. At our like everyday energy levels of just like, you know, room temperature kind of thing, is the Higgs around, or is it decay too quickly?
The particle isn't around. There's not enough energy, you know, to make it.
Okay. So the idea, but of course it does get created all the time in strange senses, spaces.
I mean, there's a background of Higgs field. But we're not the particle isn't like propagating at room temperature. But there's a background of field which we're all sort of like living in, and that's what gives us mass. Like,
right.
That's what gives. I should be careful. That's what gives the
inertial.
Fundamental fermions and gauge bosons mass. Yeah, which I'm trying to be. There's more to getting. So, there's slightly more to getting mass than the Higgs, but. Yeah.
Okay, But it's a big part of it.
Yep.
All right. So we're going to create a whole bunch of energy in this giant energy interaction, this impact. We're going to see decay signatures that would have come from this Higgs particle that's theorized.
Yep.
That's kind of how we know it shows up.
That's right.
All right.
That's right. So basically what flies out of there is a bunch of light, which we can see in electromagnetic calorimeters. And we can see actually the tracks that charged particles leave.
Like a photo sheet.
It's a thing called a silicon vertex detector, which is used sort of many layers of different materials, and you can see charged particles like moving through it because they collide, you know,
with particles in the material.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you can actually, you know,
take pictures.
You can actually see these things. Yeah. And they're actually pretty spectacular. Like, you know, if you look, go on CERN's website and look at, you know, pictures of events, and, you know, there's tons and tons of particles, and some of them are photons and some of them are electrons.
So we think we have a really good definition of how particles get mass. And
yep.
We have calculations and stuff. And we don't really know yet because we haven't seen the effect.
So we haven't seen the particle.
The particle. Yeah. So when this happens, if we see what we expect, we confirm that. If we don't, we have new theories that we have to create,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Pretty cool how science works. John, you had a question?
That was exactly what I was going to ask. The million-dollar question is, what happens if we don't find it?
Well, it's interesting. So we all sit around sort of taking bets about, like, you know, possibly the end of particle physics. So the worst thing that could possibly happen to us, I think, is if we find the Higgs and nothing else. If we just find the Higgs and nothing else, then we know almost everything. There's most definitely some high scale physics, but it's way too high to access. And then, you know, then we find the Higgs and we all go home. But
so you're hoping that something else will emerge.
If the Higgs and something else would be great. What would also be great is no Higgs, because then we have no idea.
And then you have to reevaluate all the theories that are out there. Look at all the equations and see.
Yeah, I mean there are theories without a Higgs that sort of, you know,
almost work.
They almost work. A lot of them are problems. So this is definitely our best bet. But it would be really exciting. It would also be exciting to see nothing, because then, like I said, there's this problem where the probability of, you know, scattering particles doesn't make any sense. So then that would mean that we're really, really wrong.
Okay.
It might be fun to be wrong.
I love that you're excited about the possibility that everything might be wrong.
Yeah, the problem is that yeah. For me it would be exciting to be completely wrong, but then you'd have to convince people to give you money to build
to
a different
figure, accelerator. To figure out what's right.
So then that's hard.
And just for clarity, if you see just the Higgs particle and nothing else, then you're at a state where the machine that we have doesn't have enough energy to see the higher stuff.
Yep.
And that's the problem, because then we'd have to be able to build another machine.
Yeah, but I mean, if you see the Higgs and nothing else, there's really no reason to expect anything else for
a lot of energy
levels.
So to the point where it's not something we can dissect. And then string theory starts getting more interesting.
But remains untestable.
Yes, I know. All right, we are speaking with Linda Carpenter. Linda has a PhD in physics from Johns Hopkins, and we are talking about particle physics, clearly the Higgs field / particle, the LHC test stuff. And, of course, we're also talking in just a minute about dark matter. The geeks today are Al Luckow, Ben Jaffe, John Tracy. I'm Lyle Troxell. You're welcome to ask us questions right now about our topic at hand. The phone number is 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Linda, I still don't exactly get how the field can produce mass. I get your analogy, and I like it, and it almost works for me. But one of the problems I have is that I've been trained over and over again to not think about waves and particles as really traveling in fields, meaning that light, the photon, does not actually travel in an ether. We've shown that. So,
right.
But you can still take that same analogy and use it with electromagnetic, correct?
Yeah, you sort of say that particles are excitations of a background field. I mean, imagine that I can only make analogies at this point, since I don't want to talk about complicated equations on radio. But, you know, imagine that I had like a thin rubber sheet that was stretched really taut, and I, you know, pinched a piece up and like let it go, and you know, some little wave would propagate across the sheet, and like that clustering is sort of what the particle
is. And that sounds like a great analogy. I like it and everything. And then I also have been slammed into my brain over and over again that photons do not travel through a field. They propagate by themselves. And there's a whole test to say that they're really particles. They're not waves. So how do you...
This doesn't mean that there's the ether. When you say that, like, particles are excitations of a background field, you're not talking about the ether. I mean, that's not consistent with like special relativity and stuff. So this is completely consistent with that. This is, you know.
Why is it completely consistent when the ether is not? No? Can't help me on that? Too mathematical?
This is the topic. If you want special relativity, this is a topic for its own
completely
own show.
Okay. All right. So there. All right. But you have a lot of faith in this because you understand the math. Is that true?
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to put it. You have to have faith.
That's the thing is because I can't. Your analogy works because you know that the math kind of supports that way of describing it in our world. Okay. Let's go on to.
Wait, I thought that was really interesting. The rest of us do have to take it on faith because we don't have the math, so we have to...
Basically, yeah.
When I say we're building this giant collider, we're looking for this particle called the... I mean, I don't know. You have to take a lot of things on faith, though, right?
I mean, it's very equivalent to if...
I mean, have you ever seen the Senate work? Like, you haven't, right? So,
right,
but you believe it exists.
Right, no.
Exactly.
Tell you that, you know. I think of it much more like a language thing, right? You're kind of translating for us. And clearly, to understand what's really happening, you have to understand that language with its math at a high level. If someone was reading Poe in English and somebody else only understood French, and then I tried to describe it to you, it's not really the poem. But my description of it might be pretty good. So it's kind of like that. Let's go on to dark matter because I'm curious about it. In general, matter that we see, meaning that light actually comes off of it, so we can actually detect it, like stars and a lot of
all matter we can see.
All matter we can see, the stuff we can talk about. It's clearly there's something there in space when we look out there. But there's also when you look at the effects of star systems and how they function at a gravity level. There's something we're not seeing.
Right.
That's the best description I have for dark matter. Can you explain more?
Yeah, so let me go back to some basic physics. So when you think of a galaxy, mostly what it is a bunch. I mean, what you see, the light that you see, is all concentrated sort of in a big blob in the center, with a little bit of stuff coming out in the arm, right? Mm-hmm. So if I was to ask you just from Newtonian mechanics, like how fast are the galaxy the stars and the outside of the galaxy
rotating around the center,
you do a simple thing where you say, okay, well, there's two forces acting on them, right? There's the gravitational force of most of the stuff in the galaxy, which is in the middle, like pulling the stuff on the edges in, and that's counterbalancing the centrifugal force, because these things are going around in a circle and that's pulling them out, and you go, they're in balance, right? So
and
then
we,
when you
we
do
call that,
that
an orbit.
This is, I'm just sure. You're balancing forces here, right? So when you do that and you say, okay, so how fast should these galaxies be going when you put it in terms of how far out they are?
Mm-hmm.
What you would think is that the farther out you go, the slower these things are going.
Right.
The velocity will go like 1 over the radius. But that's not what we measure. So we can actually measure the rotational velocity of stars on the outside of a galaxy. And it actually, on the out, it's a constant. As you go, if you go out far, it's just a constant. So that's not consistent, right? So that's not consistent with a distribution of mass that's all in the middle, okay?
Gotcha. But it is consistent with a general mass.
But if there's some other stuff which has mass called dark matter and it's distributed sort of in a different way that's not all clumped in the middle, then we can balance the equation and make it work. And it's consistent with observation.
Wow.
And so that's one thing about dark matter. I mean, we can also do this when we talk about clusters of galaxies moving. So we know that all the galaxies are flying, apart from each other. So there's, Hubble's law. It says the universe is expanding, okay? And then, so we can actually, observe, how fast things are flying apart from us. And we see, small variations from this, which are consistent with there being a lot of extra mass in between clusters of galaxies.
That we don't see.
So that's two measurements. And then there's another one, which is large-scale structure formation, which is that, all of the things in the universe aren't just evenly distributed, but they sort of have this filamentary structure where they all clump together. And in order to produce that, small oscillations of mass in the early universe will eventually evolve forward in time to produce these. But we really can't do that without dark matter either. We can't get the right structure formation without dark matter. So dark matter is necessary to make a lot of astronomical things work.
All right, so there's a lot of things supporting that.
Yep.
So just to go back to your first one of the balancing the forces of rotation, we can talk about the moon going around the Earth is very much the moon has a certain velocity. There's a connection between them with gravitational, and that is very much like holding a string and rotating something around it.
Yep.
And that has to do with those two things balancing.
Simple Newtonian mechanics.
Right. Yeah. So what you're saying is that when we take that same basic math and we look at our star system, it doesn't follow the same rules because there's clearly like a plate of mass or a whole ball of mass around
it. And it's called dark matter because it's dark, and that just means that it doesn't emit light. We can look at, the distribution.
Or any other visible energy, detectable energy.
Yeah, so we can just point different telescopes, in whatever frequency range of light we have at galaxies, and we don't see the dark matter.
Okay.
We don't see it.
Is it possible?
That's why it's dark.
Now, at one point, there was this idea that it was really large things, like large planetoids
machos,
that we don't see.
Machos, right.
Machos.
Called, like massive halo objects. Yeah.
Right. But that's mostly gone rid of it.
Yeah, because I think what ruled that out is gravitational lensing. So, like, light bends around massive objects. So you try to look for...
You start finding them.
We'd be having lensing events everywhere if that was true.
Right.
Well, I mean, we have a lot of...
Okay, so the other part of the idea is that it's a WIMP. It's a very it's a particle.
Ah, so now the idea is, what is it? So it's something weird. It's something weird that, so first of all, it has to be dark. So it doesn't
interact with electromagnetic.
It doesn't interact electromagnetically, right? And then it has to And then it has to be stable. So it has to exist. So right. So
the Higgs wouldn't work, for example, because
it would just decay.
It decays.
Right, okay. And go away. So now there's a theory that has to be exactly the right amount of dark matter. So in the early universe, when everything was really hot, we imagine dark matter as a particle. You make a bunch of it. You just collide regular things, and they annihilate and produce a pair of dark matter particles, right?
Okay.
So then at some point, the universe cools off, and you don't have enough energy to produce dark matter particles. So what happens is that it starts to annihilate itself, right? But then the universe expands and makes the dark matter sort of fly away from the other dark matter. So it's like less probable to collide with other particles.
Okay.
And that's what's called freeze out. And when that happens, the amount of dark matter just basically freezes, and it doesn't have a high probability of annihilating itself. So
you're talking about a dark matter particle and an anti-dark matter particle?
Yeah.
Okay. So does that mean that our solar system is made up of one of those, just like it is made up of mostly...
No. All it's everything that you see is made of matter and not antimatter.
Right. But is there also matter and antimatter dark particles? Is that the concept?
It's
or right
like
now,
dark particles.
Still... Okay. Go on.
Everything's bright. Yeah. So... Right. So what you need for all of this to work is that you need the exact right kind of interactions that dark matter has in order for there to be enough of it that it's still around, it survived from the early universe. But you don't want to have so much of it that it produces, so much gravitation that it crunches the universe down, or it would have caused the destruction of the universe before now.
Mm-hmm.
So then you postulate that it's a certain kind of particle called a weakly interacting massive particle. So weakly interacting is or WIMP, which is some unfortunate terminology. and then there's different varieties of these things. There's super WIMPs, unfortunately.
We know a lot about this particle names. In the sense that we know all those things you just mentioned. We also know that it's around, right?
Yep.
It's here to some degree.
Yep.
So is there a possibility that we're going to detect it in some way?
So there's three ways that you can detect it. So you can make it, if that's possible. You can maybe collide two regular particles together. They'll annihilate and make dark matter. You can break it where it annihilates itself and produces regular particles, and we can detect those. Or you can sort of bounce off of it, so we can collide elastically or inelastically with normal matter. And we can measure the recoil.
Yeah. Okay. So if it does something we don't expect, we know that there's something there defecting.
So we can look for it in accelerators that's making it. We can look for the products of what we expect its annihilation to be.
Uh-huh.
And we can look for recoil.
Very cool. And are we possibly going to be able to do those things in the LHC?
There are a bunch of experiments around now that we hope will be able to look for these signals. So there's a flying satellite called Fermi right now that has some interesting signals that might turn out to be dark matter. We're not sure. There's a experiment in a mine called DAMA that's sort of measuring a wind of dark matter from the center of the galaxy, or they claim to be measuring that. So it remains to be seen. But there are a lot of experiments we could possibly use. Actually.
Okay, and just we know how much it is, how much dark matter is in the universe to some degree, right? Because these
know
calculations.
What the abundance
should be, yeah. So what's the percentage of dark matter versus matter we can see?
Much more dark matter. Much more.
Like how much more?
Five times, yeah.
Five
times? No, not five times. Like baryons are only a few percent of what normal matter is, like only a few percent of the matter in the universe. Most of it is dark energy, and about a quarter of it is dark matter.
Wow.
Yeah, 22% is supposed to be dark matter.
Wow.
Yeah. 4% is actual matter, and then the rest is dark energy.
Five-ish times, yeah.
Linda, thank you so much. Linda Carpenter is has a PhD from Johns Hopkins University in physics. Her dissertation was on supersymmetry. I think we might have to come on and talk about supersymmetry again. And I really appreciate you joining us on GeekSpeak today.
No problem.
And can people ask through email other questions of you?
Sure.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at kusp.org. GeekSpeak on KUSP is registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. The Geeks today, Al Luckow, Ben Jaffe, John Tracy. Our guest today was Linda Carpenter. My name's Lyle Troxell. Al, you got a minute and 20. What's the crazy USB device of the week?
Well, as always, if you've come across these, be sure to email them in to me. This one's from listener Paul Jacob Roberts, and it's called the Rhythmix Pendulum, Total Circadian Balancing something or other. And it's this pendulum that you, or not a pendulum, but it's just like a little thing. You plug into your USB port, it charges it up, you wear it, and it reestablishes your circadian rhythm.
I hate to ask, but what's a circadian rhythm?
You know, it's got all this stuff in here about Fibonacci frequencies and electromagnetic interference and stuff. I think the people who get this are the same ones that wear the tinfoil on their heads.
Okay.
It's very expensive. And like, you can plug it in, and supposedly it does something. So it's another crazy US. And the website is Nutesla? No, New Tesla. I think Nutesla is a better way to say it. But hey, you know, I mean, whoever feels they need this, you know, and have the money, it's another crazy USB device. Send them in if you have them.
Thank you, Al. This is KUSP Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. Geeks, thanks for being here. See you next week.